ABCs of NMOSD is an education podcast series to share knowledge about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMOSD, a rare relapsing autoimmune disorder that preferentially causes inflammation in the optic nerves and spinal cord. ABCs of NMOSD podcast series is hosted by SRNA, the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and in collaboration with the Sumaira Foundation for NMO and Guthrie Jackson Charitable Foundation. This education series is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics. Hello and welcome to the ABCs of NMOSD podcast series. ABCs of NMOSD is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics. Horizon is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare autoimmune and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Horizon believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. My name is Rebecca Whitney, Associate Director of Pediatric Programs with the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association. Today I had a conversation with Drs. Jane Ness and Sylvia Tenenbaum, a second part on pediatric NMOSD, focusing on symptoms and treatments. Dr. Jane Ness is Professor of Pediatric Neurology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, or UAB. She has directed the UAB Center for Pediatric Onset Demyelinating Disease since its founding in 2006. The center is based at Children's of Alabama, the children's hospital adjacent to UAB's medical center. Dr. Ness has been involved in clinical trials for pediatric NMOSD, and she is especially interested in long-term outcomes of children and adolescents with demyelinating disease. Dr. Sylvia Tenenbaum is a pediatric neurologist who received her MD with honors from the University of Buenos Aires and acquired further training and certification in pediatric neurology in Argentina. She serves as associate professor and chief of clinics at the Department of Neurology, National Pediatric Hospital Dr. J. Garahan, a tertiary referral pediatric hospital in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Dr. Tenenbaum is the director of the Pediatric Neuroimmunology Program at the same institution. She has had a long-standing interest in a wide range of CNS neuroimmune disorders with pediatric onset and has established a comprehensive care clinic for children and adolescents with multiple sclerosis, neuromyelitis optica, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, MOG antibody-associated disease, autoimmune encephalitis, and related disorders. Her research interest focuses on the identification of novel biomarkers of autoimmune neurological disorders in children, the identification of clinical and neuroimaging characteristics of pediatric multiple sclerosis and autoimmune disorders targeting AQP4 and MOG antibodies, and optimizing treatment approaches for children with these diseases. Dr. Tenenbaum and Dr. Ness, thank you for joining me once again to discuss pediatric NMOSD. We had some excellent questions and answers the last podcast, and this time we'd like to focus on some of the treatment and symptom management in pediatric NMOSD. If I could start off with what are the most common symptoms a child may present with if they have an NMOSD diagnosis? Are they different than what we would see in adults? Does it differ by the age of the child? Dr. Ness, do you want to start?
Sure, happy to. I think that NMOSD is sort of the classic, of course, is, you know, optic neuritis, especially with a rather fixed visual loss, and transverse myelitis. But over a third of our kids have also brainstem syndrome. And so, again, one of the core features can be the area postrema syndrome, where there's intractable vomiting and hiccups, but also with, you know, number of brainstem symptoms. And there can also be excessive, you know, tiredness. What I've noticed is that these children are often really tired, very sleepy, but they're not really encephalopathic. You know, so they wake up and they can answer a question appropriately and then they fall right back to sleep.
Okay.
I'm almost thinking about them as we go through MRI. But sometimes, you know, they'll have these, you know, really large, you know, often there's headache. There'll be these large lesions that are almost tumefactive. And so they're often there'll be more, you know, I think more headache. And again, you know, they'll be sleepy, but appropriate when you wake them. And then trying to figure out, you know, is this really encephalopathy? I think that's probably the biggest thing. And some kids are truly encephalopathic, but it's a different flavor than what I see with the ADEM kids. Sylvia, have you seen similar? I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree with you. Exactly your explanation. Yeah.
Okay. And by encephalopathic, just for those who may not fully understand what that means, is that more of like the lethargy, the confusion?
Thank you for asking for that clarification, because often the kids, what I've seen is that the kids with truly acute disseminated encephalomyelitis or ADEM, those kids are sleepy, but then they're cranky. They don't know their, you know, almost don't know their parents sometimes, which is, I mean, that's pretty severe. And don't, you know, are very, you know, are little older ones confused about what, you know, what day it is or where they are. An NMO kid will be able to answer appropriately, but fall right back asleep.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. And is that what you see in adults as well, who maybe, or that probably is not the most appropriate question for two pediatric practitioners.
But actually, encephalopathic features are more frequent in the pediatric age group.
Okay.
So we are most accustomed to see those kinds of a way of starting or presenting the disease. But in adult patients, it's more the involvement of the visual acuity or the dysfunction of the spinal cord, mainly.
Okay. And do you see a difference if a child, because we know that a diagnosis of NMOSD does not require an AQP4 positive test. Is there any difference in symptoms between those kids who will test positive for AQP4 and those that do not?
In my experience, there is no much difference. Maybe there is a difference among those seronegative for AQP4, which later are positive for MOG antibodies, myelin, oligodendrocyte, glycoprotein, because indeed they have a particular way of suffering the disease and the MRI looks different.
Okay. And how does it look different between them?
The inflammation of the optic nerves are quite more severe in the MOG, in the MOGAD group.
Okay.
With papillitis, the fundoscopy is abnormal.
Okay.
So you have a very inflammation of the optic nerve. So the child may become blind, absolutely blind, at the start of the optic nerve involvement. It's more usual in AQP4 positive children to involve the chiasma. It's more posterior, the involvement of the optic nerve. And the spinal cord is more usual in the MOGAD group of patients, involvement of the conus and pericanus inflammation. So the bladder dysfunction is more frequent in the MOGAD group than in the AQP4 IgG positive group.
Okay.
When the spinal cord is more frequently involved in the upper section of the spine. So it's more upper limbs, involvement of the medulla, so the area postrema syndrome, the vomiting, and the ICAPS recurrent vomiting that Jane have described very well, are more frequent in the AQP4 IgG group.
Okay.
And not so frequent in the MOGAD. So the clinical picture is different.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the timing of the onset? I think of the NMO patients as sometimes being a little bit more stuttering. I mean, I'm thinking of when we talk about the kids with aquaporin 4 IgG positive will often have had like trips to the GI doctors, for example, for vomiting and weight loss, and even not even have much on their MRI initially, except perhaps like the most subtle, area postrema, but you did, you know, you don't get a sagittal T2 foot, you know, to look at the brainstem, you could miss it. And where I'm thinking the mod kids tend to be, as I'm thinking in retrospect, seem to be a more fulminant onset, often more of a, you know, they were fine. And then over a couple of days or, you know, week or so, they become really sick. But I'm thinking a lot of these aquaporin 4 positive children will have had something that in retrospect, you know, that was some weeks or even months ago that you think, oh, that must have been the first, you know, oh, it was the flu. They were really sick. They were vomiting, but oh no, there was no fever. No, there was no diarrhea. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, so they perform a CT scan just to see if there is a tumor, a brain tumor, and you are not going to see or detect the area postrema inflammation in the CT scan. You need a brain MRI.
And you need
sagittal cuts in order to identify the inflammation.
Exactly.
Okay.
You lose time.
Yes. Unfortunately, that does seem to be the case when we hear of individuals being diagnosed, that they've lost time in between getting that diagnosis and when they were presenting with those symptoms. So you talked a little bit about some of those symptoms that a parent or caregiver might see in a child, you know, with those hiccups, and those hiccups are severe, persistent, they continue for a long time. And those GI symptoms, feeling flu-like, having that vomiting, anything else?
They are refractory to symptomatic therapy.
Okay.
So the pediatrician of the specialist in gastroenterology put symptomatic therapy for the vomiting, and the child is not responding well, you have to start thinking in another diagnosis. Mm-hmm. It's probably the central nervous system, the one which is involved.
Yes.
Okay. So it's refractory to the usual therapy that the child received far from the neurological point of view. So they are refractory to the symptomatic therapy.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I had actually made a list for Guthy Jackson. This was years ago. And I'm actually looking at my list that I have as a weird symptoms in PEDS NMO patients. And I would just be curious, Sylvia, if you agree, I'm just going to run down the list. It was when they were revising their book. And I go, oh yeah, let me put down all the weird symptoms that I've seen. So I had puberty too early or too late. So a lot of kids with precocious puberty, I had, or that they had normal menses. And then now young women or girls have very irregular periods. Or they have, I've seen accelerated puberty or fallen below the growth curve. So that was one. I don't know if you've noticed any of those symptoms. Okay. And I've seen, as I'm thinking about some of these examples, some of these I've seen with children who ended up being MOGAD, but most of these were true aquaporin 4 positive patients. The other thing is, I guess this really goes more to the spinal cord, but just many aphaptic symptoms. So when I went back and was looking through our list of, you know, kids, like there's children who had mostly spinal cord, but were like sent home with Benadryl because they had they said it was a rash, but there's no rash document. They actually had recurrent itching and it was aphaptic. I think it was aphaptic. And again, when I started looking for it, it was different, you know, or chest tightness that they thought was panic attack or anxiety from the abdominal tightness or the chest tightness. So I've had several children with sudden uncontrolled muscle spasms that, again, I realized were aphaptic symptoms or autonomic instability. Mottled skin. I'm trying to remember, you know, libido reticularis, almost like this kind of a Raynaud syndrome. Syncope, dizziness, and then the hiccups and belching. Myalgia, so I had difficulty urinating. Also, you know, when I think of brainstem syndrome, a lot of soft voice, you know, just being, you know, they just hypophone, all the Lhermitte syndrome. I've developed great, great respect for the spinal cord and all the symptoms you can have.
The localized itching is very frequent in children. And usually pediatricians do not think about a spinal cord inflammation or involvement.
It's very interesting. And once you're coming to the NMO diagnosis in the acute phase, what are the typical treatments? Is there an order of priority that you begin with for those acute treatments for children? Dr. Tenenbaum, if you want to start with that?
Yes, the recommended first-line therapy for an MOSD, whatever, RGP4 positive, negative, or MOG positive, is typically the high-dose intravenous corticosteroids. So it's methylprednisolone, high-dose for 5 days at the minimum. And if the patient is recovering not so good, we usually go on for 10 days of intravenous methylprednisolone. Nevertheless, in cases with severe steroid, corticosteroid-resistant acute events, maybe a very severe spinal cord inflammation without recovering walking ability, or very severe optic nerve inflammation with no improvement in the visual acuity, or children in the intensive unit under mechanical ventilation due to refractory brainstem inflammation, you require a more aggressive acute therapy like therapeutic plasma exchange, okay, which is a very important adjunctive therapy. Maybe the second line after the corticosteroid treatment, or maybe the first line if the patient is so severely disabled that you need to act very quickly.
Yeah, what I tell our residents is if you can't walk, can't talk, can't think, can't breathe, can't see, yeah, that's an indication for plasma exchange.
For plasma exchange. Okay. And it's an extraordinary treatment tool for the acute treatment of this kind of inflammation. We have a great experience. Almost 90% of the patients demonstrate marked improvement after 1 month after finishing the procedures, and almost 98% at 6 months. So the treatment continue being with positive impact after you finished the intravenous procedures of plasma exchange. So it's extremely useful. Mm-hmm. And if we are thinking about starting plasma exchange, we are not going to give the patients IVIG because we are going to wash the treatment.
Exactly. I'll do what I call an IVIG chaser at the end.
Exactly. Change protocol. We perform every other day the procedures. Right. And every day until the end of the treatment, we add cyclophosphamide, oral cyclophosphamide to the patient in order to avoid the increase of the IgG because the procedure is every other day. So you may have an increase in the IgG activation in the middle. So cyclophosphamide is absolutely useful. And I think that's the reason we are so well the results that we have with plasma exchange in children.
What dose?
2 milligrams per kilogram per day.
What day do you start it?
Sorry?
What day do you start the oral cyclophosphamide?
The first day of plasma exchange. And you give it to the patient every day, the day they receive exchange and the day they are not going to be washed.
So about 10 days?
Yes, do them the 10 days. Depending on the number of procedures you need or the number of the procedures the patient need.
And do you stop at the last day of plasma exchange?
Yeah.
I've never used that before.
It's a rheumatologic protocol. They are very aggressive when they decided to use plasma exchange in the lupus, in the severe events. Oh. They are very severe events. So particularly in MOGAD patients, you need this.
Good to
because
know.
The chance of having a very good evolution of this young patients is to be aggressive in the acute stage. You can manage the sequela, you can manage the residual symptoms, but that's a problem. That's a very severe problem. It's better that you have to avoid the sequela, treating aggressively in the acute stage.
Could I ask you, do you taper or not taper prednisone?
We usually taper corticosteroids. After finishing the pulse therapy intravenously, we start with oral prednisone, 1 milligram per kilogram per day, 10, 12 days. And after that, we started to going down with the dose, usually in 4-6 weeks with cortisol evaluation in the serum sample, in order to see if we can stop the oral prednisone after the 6 weeks. Okay, so we perform tapering of corticosteroids. Yes, in order to avoid new symptoms of inflammation, particularly MOGAD, patients with MOGAD.
This is interesting because just to give you an idea of, you know, that there's different regional differences in how people do it. And I think it's very institution specific. There's places that always taper, but then with the MOG patients, it would seem like you would taper them and then a week later they would bounce back. I've stopped tapering using a taper that the past couple of years. And again, I'm not sure if it's the right or wrong way, but do you have any difficulty with having patients of either aquaporin 4 or MOG positive that will have recurrent symptoms once they come off the taper?
More frequently, we receive a second opinion children that looks like a relapse, and really they have no received tapering of corticosteroids. They just stop intravenously, and after 1 week, they start with new symptoms. More frequently, we see that. Relapses or reaggravation of the same first event after stopping intravenous corticosteroids without tapering.
So you kind of answered one of my next questions in a bit of that conversation there, but the aquaporin 4 antibody levels can be altered with the acute treatments. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correctly? So if you are giving the steroids or even the plasma exchange, those, it's adjusting the levels of the antibody that's causing the issues. Is that a fair statement? Or
I'm going to jump in and say theoretically, because once I have a positive NMO or positive aquaporin 4, I never check again, unless there's like a reason for a trial or something. And I have seen children on rituximab who then had undetectable aquaporin 4 levels and were able to get into a clinical trial only because, thanks be to God, Mayo had kept their positive samples and was able to send them for retesting to prove that they were positive at one point to get them into the clinical trial. But that's all I'm going to say about the levels, because I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. Sylvia, I don't know if you do differently, if you follow the levels.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree with you. So that's the reason it's so important to take samples, CSF and serum samples, before starting any acute therapy.
Okay.
Because you need to check the antibodies before starting treatment.
Okay.
And after being positive for MOG or for acute before, I do not check those titers anymore. Because if patient is acute before, they need a chronic therapy after the acute management forever.
And do you believe that with MOGAD too?
No. MOGAD is different.
Okay.
You need the first evaluation before starting therapy, because after treatment or without acute treatment, titers go down within 6, 12, or 18 months. So you lose the chance to detect the positivity, to name the disorder MOGAD, if you don't perform the titers very early. And if I have the TARDIS very early and we are positive, I'll start acute treatment, but no chronic therapy. Is different from acute before. In MOGAD, I will wait until the second event.
Correct. So do I.
After a new MRI with a huge inflammatory signs within the spinal cord, the optic nerve of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And only when that circumstances occur, I start immunosuppression.
Yes.
It's different in that way from acute before. Acute before force you to start immunosuppressive treatment. And it's not the case with MOGAD.
I agree. And again, similar, you know, I don't, you know, as I said before, I don't follow the aquaporin 4 levels. Once you're positive and call it a day. And I had been following the MOGAD levels, and I'm not sure that it means anything. I know there's people who say you should check every 6 months, and I'm thinking about MOG antibody titers almost along the line of the aquaporin 4 titers, except for, you know, the treatment decisions, again, similar to Sylvia, as I, you know, wait for a second attack before I drop, because there's kids that, you know, not once the MOG antibody became commercially available from Mayo at, you know, late 2017. Then I started, you know, going through and, you know, checking all the, you know, there were kids who had only one attack and were MOG positive. And some of them had higher titers and the kids would have recurrent, you know, a couple of attacks. So
MOG antibodies are tricky because you may have Absolutely. A patient that converted to seronegative after being positive. And after 1, 5, or 10 years, they have relapse.
Yes, yes, they can go.
And other patients that remain low positive, low positive, low positive, and never have a clinical relapse. And the MRI stayed silent, so you are not going to give immunosuppression according to the serum status. I don't think it's useful, at least up today. I think there is not useful to continue checking the serum levels of MOG antibodies in pediatric patients, at least. I don't have experience with adults, but I think it's the same story.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
Very
interesting.
They are. These MOGADs are, we're still getting it.
It's so interesting and interesting to hear how the MOG differs from the AQP4. And obviously with the AQP4, like you said, if you have it, immunosuppressant therapy is necessary. And so that's something that we know they'll have a recurrence if they are not treated on those immunosuppressants. So does the level of the antibody that may be present at the initial attack in AQP4, does it determine the risk of relapse? Does it determine if it's going to be more severe, that the symptoms are worse, or the disability becomes worse?
If I understand well, you are trying to express if the very high titers of AQP4 antibodies have a prognostic value for a very severe ongoing disease. And I don't think that is real.
Okay.
You are positive. You may be low positive or very high positive. It's just NMOSD, AQP4 IgG positive disease. And you need to start immunosuppression. Okay. Mm-hmm. All the relapses you may observe in a patient after the first event in AQP4 or in MOG patients, in MOG positive patients, maybe the risk is to have more residual deficits after the following relapses because you are having inflammation after an optic nerve, for example, that have already been severely attacked or inflamed with the initial event. So that's the reason you are aggressive with immunosuppression and try to follow the cycles of the treatment in order to avoid or suppress the following relapses. Because the children is going to finally be blind.
Right.
And that's the very severe sequela from NMOSD. From MOGAD, from MOG positive children. So the tricky here is to sustain the immunosuppression in a way that you avoid the relapses, independently of the level of the antibodies. So that's a problem of rituximab, for example, that you may consider giving an additional dose every 6 months, but children, particularly younger children, may have an increase of the antibodies in the serum before the CD19 baby may become positive above the value of 1% before the 6 months. And there you have a relapse, a severe relapse.
Okay.
So you have to decide the best way of following those kids under immunosuppression, particularly with mycophenolate. You have this, an oral immunosuppressive drug. You have to adjust the dose to the body weight. So every immunosuppressive treatment require a very close follow-up a very close monitoring in order to avoid relapses, because that's the objective of starting immunosuppression.
I agree with you, Sylvia. I find that when we kind of beginning at the original start of the question, does a higher titer predict worse disease? I've seen terrible disease with someone who had rather low titers. And of course, in the beginning, we just got, you know, the results I got was positive or negative. I never got a titer back. And so I agree that I'm not sure that the titer is very predictive, because I've seen people, you know, kids with what, you know, was high disease, especially now more recently with MOGAD, that have super high disease that have not had, have had pretty uneventful courses, and children with low titers that have done, you know, have been a struggle for me. And then how with the kids on rituximab, which is all the NMO kids, once they become, you know, I put them on rituximab, you know, I treat their stare, you know, we have three things for acute relapses, maybe now a three plus, you know, steroids, immune globulin, which I think is a little bit more helpful, maybe in the MOGADs, you know, and again, I use it after the plasmapheresis, as does Sylvia. And then plasmapheresis, that now I'm going to add a little dusting of cyclophosphamide. But, you know, that it really hasn't changed. But then for long term, I immediately put the kids, you know, regardless of, you know, the NMO, the aquaporin 4 positive on rituximab. And I can tell you a story of one child who had a non-focal exam except for nausea and vomiting, and just barely anything in the area post-stream. And we argued about if there was something in the spinal cord or not. And I didn't treat her. You know, it was kind of we discussed it with the family. And a year later, she had a horrible relapse. I mean, she recovered, but it took a really long time. I learned my lesson. I knew, you know, the numbers in the literature about 70% chance of relapse with a positive aquaporin 4 titer. And aquaporin, you know, I think of the aquaporin 4 positive patients don't take a cognitive hit in the same way that I feel like the MS patients do. I'm still undecided about the MOGAD patients. Mm-hmm. I've certainly seen it happen, but I think for sure in the aquaporin 4 patients, it's the cognitive issues are driven, or, you know, they're just neurological poor outcomes are driven by the relapses. Mm-hmm. And if you can prevent the relapses, I think we can prevent a lot of other problems cognitively and physically. And then, so I follow B cells, and I certainly have seen patients who have repopulated their B cells, and I try and keep their B cells below an absolute number below 5 or less than 1, but I use 5 as a cutoff, redose them. And then usually just automatically redose every 6 months. But if they repopulate earlier, then some kids I have to squeeze together every 3 to 4 months, rituximab. And then after followed them, if they're zero B cells for a while, then I'll stretch them back out to 6 months again.
Okay. All right. So you talked a little bit about some of those ongoing treatments with the rituximab, the mycophenolate. Any other treatment options for the ongoing immunosuppression that you use in children? And you touched on this just a little bit as far as, can they outgrow that treatment? Does it need to be adjusted or changed? And is it possible for a child to, and I believe we've already answered this, but I just want to ask it one more time, for a child to outgrow the diagnosis, can they go years on immunosuppressant therapy with absolutely no recurring attacks to then be able to come off of those therapies?
So this is what I tell my patients, mm-hmm. is that if they're aquaporin 4 positive, this is a lifelong disease. And in, you know, the current year, I've been saying this since we found the antibody, that this is considered, you know, for the time being, that they should be planning to be on therapy lifelong.
Okay. And have you had to adjust medications, whatever those immunosuppressants might be, because the one may no longer work and they have a recurrence? Is that something that's monitored? You know, you mentioned, you know, checking B cell levels and doing mm-hmm. that. How are those patients monitored? So just thinking, you know, if a child is diagnosed when they're 5 and then they're 15, you know, monitoring for the changes that happen just during the stage of growing, does that impact those therapies that they may be in?
So puberty, of course, is a big issue. Do they get normal or not? But I think that the puberty is more disrupted by the aquaporin 4, you know, being present. my experience has been that actually our aquaporin 4 patients do really well on rituximab. The biggest side effect I've seen has been that some of them will develop recurrent upper respiratory infections. And I've had a few kids too with pneumonias. That one child ended up switching to sartralizumab, the IL-6, interleukin 6 receptor inhibitor that was known as tozalizumab, used intravenously, but then now that it's a subcutaneous injection once a month. And so I've had two patients, you know, switch to that for those reasons. And I haven't used any of I haven't used a complement inhibitor yet. It's the MOGAD positive, the MOG positive patients who have failed rituximab, in my experience. I mean, the ones that didn't do well, they were the aquaporin 4 negative, and then in retrospect, they ended up being MOG positive. And those kids seem to not do as well on rituximab. I don't know, Sylvia, what's your experience? I'm eager to see what you think.
Yes, the clinical response to rituximab is not as good in children with MOGAD. That's real. So we start with rituximab because we still think that it's a very good immunosuppressive therapy, particularly in pediatric patients. But after realize that we are failing because you have an additional relapse, even having CD19 in 0, children with MOGAD may relapse. So probably it's a different pathophysiology that we still do not understand quite well. Mm-hmm. So after having that, we may add oral mycophenolate, mofetil, adjunctive to the rituximab. That's one way to try to control the disease. And if you additional have another relapse, you may stop one of those, particular rituximab, for example, and continue with maintenance IVIG. So every month receiving one dose of intravenous IVIG for chronic therapy, not for the acute attacks, you know, for chronic therapy, not exclusively with IVIG, but as an add-on therapy with mycophenolate, for example. We still do not have approved the 3 new molecules, eculizumab or inebilizumab or satralizumab, for its use in pediatric patients. We do not have those new treatments approved, so we cannot use it nowadays. And if finally you fail again with the addition of IVIG, well, we have to sustain oral steroids because MOG antibodies positive patients still respond to corticosteroids. So probably they only need chronic therapy with corticosteroids with all the secondary effects, cataracts and osteopenia that are very bad with chronic therapy with corticosteroids. But many kids that have no other option. So it's very hard. The chronic treatment of a patient with MOGAD, with a relapsing form of MOGAD, is very severe. But okay, probably in my experience, it's just the 3-4% of all the MOGAD pediatric population that have so refractory behavior of the disease. Because MOGAD patients with positive antibodies that require immunosuppression may need to sustain the treatment for just 2 years. And after 2 years of being the disease stable from the clinical and the neuroimaging point of view, you may try to start tapering the immunosuppression. And many patients tolerate quite well that management. You cannot do that in acute before IgG positive patients. So that's another difference. Very important difference between the two diseases.
Okay. Could you repeat that again? The last sentence about MOGAD, something about their antibody as you take right before you taper, what do you do? Or wait before ending therapy, trying to come off therapy at 2 years?
After 2 years. In very severe one, you can do it after 4 years, so immunosuppression. So between 2 and 4, mm-hmm. patients absolutely stable. I repeat MRIs every 6 months. So if I have new signs of inflammation, particularly in the spinal cord and the optic nerve, a single isolated lesion in the white matter doesn't mean nothing for me. But
right, exactly.
Inflammation in the spinal cord or the optic nerve means different impact in the functional neurological sequela, potential sequela. So absolutely stable from the neuroimaging point of view and absolutely clean from the clinical examination and with no relapses, you can start to take out the immunosuppression.
And that's specific to MOG.
MOG. Correct. Only for okay. MOG.
Yep.
Right.
Not NMO. A for AQP4, absolutely.
Right.
No. Right. Okay. NMO, they're on forever. And I keep on hoping, you know, that we get some adult data, but I you know, so I think, you know, thinking about planning for, you know, because many of our, you know, majority of our aquaporin 4 patients are female, is thinking about family planning. And yes, you can have babies, but with, you know, these have to be planned babies. And, you know, that's when, of course, we send them off to the adult neurologist. But you know, again, you know, many ways that they, you know, cognitively actually do very well, but preventing the relapses is really essential.
That's the critical piece. Yeah.
Yes.
So, and thinking about these ongoing lifelong immunosuppressants for these kids, are there additional tests, precautions that need to be considered? So you mentioned earlier some who may struggle with having upper respiratory infections. Are there things that should be checked that need to be thought of when they're starting on that immunosuppressant therapy?
Before starting immunosuppression, you need to check for antibodies to varicella because it's a live vaccine. Mm-hmm. The live virus vaccine, and for hepatitis B.
Yes.
Because if the patient is seronegative for those virus, you have to vaccinate the patient before starting immunosuppression, if you have time. If you have time to wait until you seroconvert to IgG positive for varicella. And after that, you can start immunosuppression and checking for IgG because hypogammaglobulinemia is a complication of the chronic therapy with rituximab. So in that cases, if the hypogammaglobulinemia is symptomatic, if the patients have recurrent upper respiratory infections, you need to give IVIG to increase the level of IgG.
Yes.
In order to continue sustaining the immunosuppression because the patient needs that. In the middle of the pandemic, it was another problem with the vaccines for SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. And we avoid that in order to wait until the CD19 was positive above the level of 2-3%. And that's what the window of opportunity to vaccinate the patient for COVID.
Okay.
And after completing the 2 doses, 3 weeks after the second dose, we give the additional intravenous dose of rituximab. So we do not have, usually during these 2 years, we didn't have difficulties with that. So it's possible.
Okay.
And now the American Centers for Disease Control has actually recommended that patients who are immune suppressed should actually have 3 doses of the mRNA vaccine to be considered even minimally vaccine, you know, as a baseline for vaccination. So, you know, dose 1, this is really referring to the mRNA vaccines, then 3 or 4 weeks later, dose 2, and then 4 weeks later, dose 3 to really be considered to be, to be fully vaccinated. And I think that probably, you know, dose 4, you know, 5 or 6 months later, and who knows about another subsequent follow-up dose. So I think, you know, we're learning as we go along.
And is there a need for annual MRIs? Do you do MRIs if there is not any clinical symptoms, or do you do them in case there are any silent lesions that may be present?
During the first 2 years under treatment for AQP4 or for MOG, I perform MRI, complete MRI. Dedicated orbital, brain, and spinal every 6 months during the first 2 years. If the patient is absolutely stable, in AQP4, I perform yearly. Every year, I request for an MRI.
Okay.
And it is not so clear if the silent new lesions have some impact announcing that a new relapse is near. Because it's, as I expressed previously, it's not the same to have a silent lesion in the middle of the brain white matter, a mm-hmm. single small dot, that you have a longitudinal new enhancement in one optic nerve and the patient is still not suffering from any visual. It's completely different.
Okay.
One is near to be symptomatic in the near future, mm-hmm. the one involving the optic nerve. So it's not so clear prognostic indicator of a silent lesion in the IQP4, and it's not so clear in the MOGAD group. Very recently in Durinet Creams, if the European Congress of MS, two separate papers were presented, both in adult patients, and one including children with MOGAD. And for MOGAD patients, adult patients, they have was an a new silent lesion was indicative of a near close relapse going to occur. In the other paper with the pediatric patients, the ones from the Philadelphia group, including Canadian children, demonstrated that new silent lesions have not so predictive value of a relapse in the MOGAD group. So it looks like it's different experience in adult and in children. I think we need more cohorts being evaluated in order to establish the value of the new silent lesions. In the meanwhile, I perform an MRI. If the patient is an adolescent and is, okay, I don't want more. mm-hmm. Probably is very stable under immunosuppression during the last 7 years, 10 years. Probably I will examine every year the patients from the neurological point of view and request an MRI after 3 years from the mm-hmm. previous one. That's adjusted according to the patient. Okay. But during the first 2 or 3 years, I'm more closely follow these kids.
And I would agree that I follow similarly follow them more closely. I will do like every, you know, like, you know, 3 to 6 months later, depending how sick they were. And then, you know, maybe 6 months later and then a year later. And then if they've looked pretty clean, that the aquaporin 4 positive patients, I've tended not to follow with annual MRIs, but more with exam. You know, I used to do annual MRIs and then I sort of fell away from it because they were, you know, it was really driven more by their symptoms than by their MRI. I wasn't seeing really very many silent lesions at all in the MRIs of the aquaporin 4 positive patients. The MOGAD patients can have silent, it can definitely have silent lesions that sneak up on you and bite you. But, you know, those kids I'm, you know, typically doing every year. And again, you know, and the MS, which I know this isn't, you know, we're talking about MS, but, you know, sort of that's, so, you know, I think of that as my framework. And then how do I differ depending on their antibody status a little bit? So I've actually fallen away from chasing the aquaporin 4 patients as frequently with MRI, but maybe I'll go back to what I used to do.
If a parent or caregiver of a child is immunosuppressant therapy and they believe that they may be experiencing a relapse, what are some of the indicators that you may give to them to look for to help determine, is this really a relapse or are they coming down with another illness that may be almost seeming like they're going through this relapse again? Do you follow kind of a 24-hour rule? Anything like that, that would give families an indicator as to when they need to reach out to say, I think something is happening.
I'm going to start with, so with our MS patients, we say, wait 24 hours before they call us. But we usually hear about it before they, but if it's 24 hours, it's going to be something, but we want to know about it. The MOGAD and NMO patients, oh no, I mean, they can go blind overnight. You know, so we're going to, you know, so it becomes a lot harder. It does seem like kids seem to have sort of the same flavor. I mean, like a headache, you know, a headache may accompany it, but often kids will be able to tell you there's a difference. I have a low threshold to look sooner and eventually we kind of get the hang of it and I'll rescan it. You know, I have a low threshold to rescan quickly. So I treat that, I jump on that MOGA, especially the aquaporin 4 positive patients a lot faster. But again, with the aquaporin 4 patients on rituximab really do nicely.
Okay. And the same in your experience, Dr. Tenenbaum?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's absolutely different from MS. Here you have to pay attention to the patients. Mm-hmm. And I teach the children, not the parents, the children.
Yeah.
You have to check your visual acuity while you're seeing television, trying with one eye and the other, you know, if exactly. Mm-hmm. Do that. Okay, when you have time, do that and check yourself and tell your mama that they bring you to the hospital, because if there is some difference, you need an MRI. Or you need a fundoscopy, because in more you have papillitis immediately. Mm-hmm. The kid is saying, I see different with this eye, and you look at the fundoscopy and you will see the inflammation of the optic nerve. So that is a optic nerve relapse. Mm-hmm. Of some difference in the muscle strength with one leg or the other, or bilateral. Mm-hmm. So those are signs that the kid is going to come and tell you, okay, I think it's different, I have something, even with the headache.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They may have headaches in the meanwhile, but this is different. They came and tell me, this is different,
exactly.
Dr. Tulia. Is behind my left eye, so this is different. Kids are great. They can describe perfectly well.
Yes.
I think I have something different.
Yeah. Or the other thing is itching. Sometimes it'll be tingling in the feet. It'll be some little vague sensory symptoms that almost don't make neurologic sense. It'll be, you know, bilateral, you know, tingling in their toes, tingling in their fingers. And, you know, we want to lay eyes on these kids. And sometimes it may take a couple of visits, you know, before I pull the, trigger, because I may, you know, I tell my patients when I first meet them, it takes me a year to get the hang of you and you a year to get the hang of me, you know, to really sort of, you know, learn how that child's going to respond.
Okay. Okay. But definitely good to know when they're experiencing those symptoms.
Yeah.
And they're AQP4. MOG positive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a wait and see. It's let's get on this now. Absolutely. All right.
And we have a huge number of double seronegative patients.
Yes.
And the cure is the same.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. With immunosuppressed, those children, if they have a relapse, it's a huge number of patients, more than those who are seropositive for MOG mm-hmm. or AQP4. Mm-hmm. And they do experience NMOSD clinical pictures. So
yes,
management is the same.
Okay.
Yeah, good. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah.
Yes,
definitely. Thank you. And just one last question, pain, neuropathic pain, is that an issue for children diagnosed with NMOSD? Is that something that you see very prevalent? And how is that managed for children?
I think that it depends on the mean age of your cohort. If you have more adolescents, more near to the adult patients, probably pain is an issue. I do not have so many patients. We have a younger, very young population. That's not a problem. It's exceptional that I have to use medication for neuropathic pain.
Okay.
For adults, it's absolutely the first residual symptom they have to manage with medication. I don't know if for Jane is the same experience.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that the NMO patients can have that pain. It can be a little bit more problematic, especially if they've had a lot of, you know, a bad cord relapse, although it seems to get better with time. But a lot of times it's when you sort of figure out pain, it's often the, you know, again, I have great respect for the spinal cord. And now I know to ask children when they've had a cord relapse, regardless of what their antibody status is, if it's neuromyelitis optica, but to ask about aphaptic symptoms, because they're just weird. And, you know, again, the itching, the paroxysmal symptoms. And so I think about, I try and figure out, you know, is it something that comes and goes? Is it 5 minutes at a time? And then it goes away, and it's another 3 to 5 minutes at a time, and then it goes away. And if it's that flavor, I typically use seizure medicine, either carbamazepine, Tegretol in the States, or oxcarbazepine, trileptal, which is really effective. And patients who've had both tell me that the oxcarbazepine is less sedating. And so that's usually now what I use as a first line for that kind of pain. And then if it's a continuous pain, I usually use gabapentin, and I'm not afraid to push the dose.
It's exceptional for me. It's really exceptional.
But it's more kind of like a fatigue, or sometimes I get some sustained burning, but I think I have a lot of adolescents.
Okay, probably.
Yeah, that's the most common, the age of onset is typically between, it's right, at the onset of puberty. I mean, again, I have a few younger NMO patients, onset as young as age 4, but most of them have been the, early 10, 11, 12, 13 onset.
All right. Well, that is all of the questions that I have for today. So thank you both very much for your time and sharing your experience and expertise with us. It is truly appreciated.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yes, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I've learned so much. It's been a great experience to, it's reassuring. If I'm on the same page as Sylvia, I always be like, that's a great thing. But learning a little, I'm going to add the cyclophosphamide to the plasma. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Great to share the experience of a North American country and from a very South American country like Argentina. Yes. So I think it's very nice to put together experience to pediatric neurologists.
Absolutely.
It's fun.
I mean, we had a ball. It was a great idea. Yeah. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank
you. Yes. Great learning for us.
Yes. Well, I'm glad we could be of help in that way.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's very, very fun.
Yes. Well, thank you both so much. I really do appreciate it.